Side 7, The Difference Engine, by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 233. Without a word, Mallory stooped to his work. He fetched the basin and sopped the hand towel, scrubbing the wet terry carefully over her breasts and the fat, navel-dimpled white rise of her belly. Hetty watched with hooded eyes, puffing at her cigaretto and flicking ashes on the floor, as if her flesh belonged to someone else. After a while, she silently gripped his prick, working it back and forth encouragingly as he wiped at her legs. Mallory put on another sheath, with some clumsy fumbling, almost losing his erection as he did so. To his relief, he managed to enter her, but he soon regained stiffness in her welcoming flesh, and thumped hard at her, tired and drunk, with an ache in his arms and his wrists and his back, and a strange, painful tingling at the root of his prick. The glands felt quite sore, almost painfully tender within its sheep-gut armor, and his bend seemed as hard and tricky as pulling a rusty nail. The bedsprings creaked like a field of metal crickets. Halfway through, Mallory felt as if he had run for miles, and Hetty, whose dead cigaretto had burnt the bureau, seemed entranced, or perhaps only stunned or drunk. For a moment he wondered if he should simply stop, quit, tell her somehow that it simply wasn't working, but he could not even begin to find the words that would satisfactorily explain this situation, so he sawed on. His mind wandered to another woman, a cousin of his, a red-haired girl whom he had seen being shagged behind a Sussex hedgerow when he had been up a tree as a boy hunting cuckoo's eggs. The red-haired cousin had married the man, and was 40 years old now with grown children, a round little proper woman in a round little proper bonnet. But Mallory never met her without remembering the tortured look of pleasure on her freckled face. He clutched that secret image now like a galley slave to his oar, and fought his way stubbornly toward a climax. Finally, there was that melting, cresting feeling in his loins that told him that he would, in fact, spend soon, that nothing would hold him back, and he shoved on with a new desperation, panting very hard, and the agonized rush of spending came up his aching spine like a rocket, a surge of shocking pleasure in his arms, in his legs, even in the naked soles of his cramping feet, and he cried out, a loud, ecstatic, bestial groan that surprised him. "Lordy," Hetty commented. Mallory collapsed off of her and lay blowing like a beached cetacean in the fetid air. His muscles felt like rubber, and he'd half-sweated the whiskey off with the sheer work of it. He felt utterly wonderful. He felt quite willing to die. If the tout had arrived and shot him on the spot, he would somehow have welcomed it, welcomed the opportunity never to come back from that plateau of sensibility, the opportunity never to be Edward Mallory again, but only a splendid creature drowned in contentiros. But after a moment the feeling was gone, and he was Mallory again. Too stupefied for any refinements of guilt or regret, Mallory nevertheless felt ready to leave. Some unspoken crisis had passed, and the episode was finished. He was simply too tired to move just yet, but he knew that he was about to. The whore's bedroom no longer felt like any kind of haven to him. The walls seemed unreal, mere mathematical abstraction, boundaries that could no longer restrain his momentum. "Let's sleep a bit," Hetty said, her words blurred with drink and exhaustion. "All right." He sensibly set the box of lucifers within convenient reach, turned out the lantern, and lay in the hot London dark like a suspended platonic soul. He rested, eyes open, a flea feasting with leisurely precision on his ankles. He did not sleep exactly, but rested for some indefinite time. When his mind began to run in circles, he lit and smoked one of Hetty's cigarettos, a pleasant ritual, though without much point as far as the proper use of tobacco went. Later he left the bed and pissed in the peau de chambre by feel. Ale had spilled on the floor there, or perhaps it was something else. He would have liked to wipe his feet, but there seemed little point. He waited for something akin to dawn to show at Hetty's bare and grimy casement, which gazed out gloomily at a nearby wall. At length there came a feeble glow, not much at all like honest daylight. He had sobered now and lay there parched, his head feeling stuffed with gun cotton. Not at all bad, really, if he didn't move it suddenly, but full of grim premonitory throbs. He lit the bedside candle, found his shirt. Hetty woke with a groan and stared at him, her hair snarled and sweaty, her eyes bulging with a look that almost frightened him. Ellying, they would have called it in Sussex. Fay.
"You're not going," she said.
"Yes."
"Why? It's so dark still."
"I prefer an early start." He paused. "An old camp habit." Hetty snorted.
"Get back in bed, my brave soldier. Don't be silly. Stay a bit. We'll wash and have breakfast. You can get that, can't you? A nice big breakfast?"
"I'd rather not. It's late. I must go. I have business."
"How late?" she yawned. "Not even dawn yet."
"It's late. I'm certain of it."
"What does Big Ben say?"
"I haven't heard Ben all night," Mallory said, the recognition surprising him. "Government have shut it down, I suppose." This bit of speculation seemed to vaguely alarm Hetty.
"French breakfast, then," she suggested. "Sent up from downstairs. Pastry, pot of coffee. It's cheap."
He shook his head. Hetty paused, narrowed her eyes. The refusal seemed to have startled her. She sat up, the bed creaking, and tugged at her disordered hair.
"Don't go out. The weather's dreadful. If you can't sleep, dear, then let's fuck."
"I don't think I can."
"I know you like me, Nettie."
She raised the sweat-dampened sheet.
"Come and feel me all over. That will make it stand."
She lay there waiting, with the sheet up. Mallory, unwilling to disappoint, came toward her, patted her lovely haunches, and groped about the luscious smoothness of her breasts. Her flesh delighted his touch, but his prick, though it stirred, did not stand. "I really must go," he said.
"It will stand again if you wait a bit."
"I can't say any more."
"I would not do this if you were not such a nice man," Hetty said slowly. "But I can make it stand right now, if you like. Connaissez-vous la belle gamahouche?"
"What's that, then?"
"Well," she said, "if you'd been with Gabrielle instead of me, you'd have had it by now. She always did it with her men, and said they were mad for it. It's what they call gamahouching, the French pleasure."
"I'm not sure I understand."
"Prick-sucking."
"Oh, that." He had heard the term, though only as the foulest kind of abusive curse, and was startled to find himself in a situation where it might be performed as a physical act. He tugged at his beard.
"Ah, how much would that cost?" "I wouldn't do it for any price, for some," she assured him. "But I do like you, Ned, and for you I'd do it."
"How much?" She blinked.
10 shillings?
"Half a pound."
"I don't think so," he said. "Well, all right, 5 shillings, if you don't finish there. But you have to promise that, and I mean it."
The implications of this proposal gave him an exquisite thrill of disgust. "No, I don't care for that." He began to dress.
"You'll come again, then. When will you see me?"
"Soon." She sighed, knowing he was lying.
"Go, then, if you must. But listen, Nettie, I do know you like me. And I don't remember your proper name exactly, but I know I've seen your portrait in the papers. You're a famous savant, and you have a deal of tin. I'm right about that, aren't I?"
Mallory said nothing. She hurried on.
"A fellow like you can get in bad trouble with the wrong sort of London girl, but you're safe as houses with Hetty Edwards, for I only go with gentlemen, and I'm very discreet."
"I'm sure that you are," Mallory said, dressing hastily.
"I dance Tuesdays and Thursdays at the Pentascopic Theatre, down Haymarket. Will you come and see me?
If I'm in London.
He left her then, and felt his way out of the place. On his hasty way to the stairs, he bloodily scraped his shin on the pedal of someone's chained bicycle. The sky above the heart was like nothing Mallory had ever seen, yet he knew it. He had seen such a sky with his mind's eye, a lowering dome abrim with explosive filth, awash with obliterating dust, a sky that was the very harbinger of catastrophe. By the twilight blur of the fully risen sun, he reckoned it near 8 o'clock. Dawn had come, yet brought no day. The land leviathans had seen this very sky, he knew, after the earth-shaking shock of the great comet. For the scaly herds, ceaselessly progressing through the teeming jungles, driven always by a mighty hunger in their great fermenting bellies, this had been the sky of Armageddon. Storms of cataclysm lashed the Cretaceous earth, vast fires raged, and cometary grit sifted through the roiling atmosphere to blight and kill the wilting foliage, till the mighty dinosauria, adapted to a world now shattered, fell in mass extinction, and the leaping machineries of evolution were loosed in chaos to repopulate the stricken earth with strange new orders of being. He scuffed down Flower and Dean Street, awestruck, coughing. He could see little more than 30 feet ahead, for the alley roiled with a low-lying yellow fog that blurred his eyes with its clinging acid tang. More by luck than design, he emerged on Commercial Street, ordinarily a thriving Whitechapel Avenue. Deserted now, its smooth tarmac was spread with fountained shards of shop-front glass. He walked a block, then another. There was scarcely a window intact. Cobbles, rubbed up from side streets, had been flung right and left like a shower of meteors. A seeming whirlwind had descended on a nearby grocery, leaving the street ankle-deep in dirty snowdrifts of flour and sugar. Mallory picked his way through battered cabbages, squashed greengages, crushed jars of syruped peaches, and the booted footballs of whole smoked hams. Scatterings of damp flour showed a stampede of men's brogues, the small bare feet of street urchins, the dainty trace of women's shoes, and the sweep of their skirt hems. 4 mist-shrouded figures, 3 men and a woman, all dressed respectably, all carefully masked in thick cloth, came shuffling into view. Noticing him, they pointedly crossed the street. They moved slowly, unhurriedly, talking together in low tones. Mallory moved on, splintered glass crunching under his shoe heels. Meyer's Gents Furnishings, Peterson's Haberdashery, Lagrange's Parisian Pneumatique Launderette, all presented disintegrated storefronts and doors torn off their hinges. Their fronts had been thoroughly pelted with stones, with bricks, with raw eggs. Now a more cohesive group appeared, men and young boys, some rolling heaped barrows, though they were clearly not costers. In their masks they seemed tired, bemused, somber, as though attending a funeral. In their aimless progress they slowed before a sacked cobbler's, picking over the scattered shoes with the limp enthusiasm of scavengers. Mallory realized that he had been a fool. While he had wallowed in mindless dissipation, London had become a locus of anarchy. He should be home in peaceful Sussex now, with the family. He should be readying for little Madeline's wedding, in clean country air, with his brothers and sisters at hand, with decent home-cooked food and decent homely drink. A sudden agony of homesickness struck him, and he wondered what chaotic amalgam of lust and ambition and circumstance had marooned him in this dreadful, vicious place. He wondered what the family were doing at that very moment. What was the time, exactly? With a jolt, Mallory remembered Madeline's clock. His sister's wedding gift was sitting in its brass haft carry case in the safety box of the Palace of Paleontology. The lovely fancy clock for dear Madeline, now grotesquely out of his reach. The palace was 7 miles from Whitechapel, 7 miles of roiling chaos. There must be some way back, some way to cross that distance, surely. Mallory wondered if any of the city's trains were running, or the omnibuses, perhaps a hansom. Horses would choke in this foul mist. He was down to Shank's mare. Likely any effort to cross London was foolish, and likely it would be wisest to cower in some quiet cellar like a rat, hoping for catastrophe to pass him over. And yet Mallory found his shoulders squaring, his legs tramping forward of their own accord. Even the throbbing in his parched head began to pass, as his wits focused on a goal. Back to the palace. Back to his life.
"Hello! Say there, sir!"
The voice echoed over Mallory's head like the cry of a bad conscience. He glanced up, startled. From a third-floor window of Jackson Brothers, Furriers and Hatters, protruded the black barrel of a rifle. Behind it, Mallory made out the balding head of a spectacled shopping clerk, leaning from his open window now to reveal a striped shirt and scarlet braces. "May I be of service?" Mallory called, the phrase emerging out of reflex.
"Thank you, sir,"
the clerk cried, his voice cracking.
"Sir, could you please have a look at our door there, just to the side, below the steps? I believe there may be someone hurt."
Mallory waved one hand in reply, walked to the shop's entrance. Its double doors were intact but badly battered, dripping splattered eggs. A young man in a sailor's striped blouse and bell-bottomed trousers lay sprawled there, face down, a pry bar of forged iron near his hand. Mallory seized the shoulder of the sailor's coarse blouse and turned him over. A bullet had taken him through the throat. He was quite dead, and his nose had been mashed to one side by the pavement, giving his bloodless young face a bizarre cast, so that he seemed to have come from some nameless country of sea-going albinos. Mallory straightened.
"You've shot him dead,"
he shouted upward. The clerk, seeming rattled, began coughing loudly and made no reply. Mallory spied the wooden butt of a pistol tucked in the dead sailor's intricately knotted sash. He tugged it out. A revolver of unfamiliar make, its massive cylinder curiously slotted and grooved. The long octagonal barrel, underhung with a sort of piston, stank of black powder. He glanced at the furrier's battered door. Clearly, an entire mob had been at it, an armed mob, bent on the worst kind of mischief. The wretches must have scattered when the sailor had been shot. He stepped into the street, waving the pistol.
"The rascal was armed," he shouted. "You did well to—"
A bullet from the clerk's rifle screamed off a cement stair-step, bleaching it white with impact, and narrowly missing Mallory on the ricochet.
"God blame ye, ye cack-handed fool!" Mallory bellowed. "Stop that, this instant!"
There was a moment's silence.
"Sorry, sir,"
the clerk cried.
"What in hell do you think you're doing?" "I said I was sorry. You best throw away that gun, though, sir." "The hell I will,"
Mallory roared, slipping the pistol into the waistband of his trousers. He meant to demand that the clerk come down and decently cover the dead man, but he thought better of it as other windows rattled up on their casters, four more rifle barrels appearing in defense of Jackson Brothers. Mallory backed up, showing empty hands and attempting to smile. When the fog had thickened around him, he turned and ran. Now he moved more cautiously, keeping to the center of the street. He discovered a trampled cambric shirt and cut its baggy sleeve loose with the small sawtooth blade of his Sheffield knife. It made a serviceable mask. He examined the sailor's revolver and plucked a blackened cartridge case from the cylinder. It still held five shots. It was a clumsy thing, foreign, unevenly blued, though the mechanism looked to have been executed with a decent degree of accuracy. He made out "Ballester Molina" stamped faintly on the side of the octagonal barrel, but there were no other markings. Mallory emerged on Aldgate High Street, recalling it from his walk with Hetty from the London Bridge Pier, though it looked, if anything, more eerie and horrid than it had in the middle of the night. The mob did not seem to have touched it as yet, in the inherent vagary of chaos. A rhythmic clanging of alarm sounded from the fog behind him. He stepped aside to watch a fire gurney steam past, its red-painted sides battered and dented. Some London mob had brutally attacked the firemen. attacked the trained men and machines that stood between the city and mass conflagration. This struck Mallory as the acme of perverse stupidity, yet somehow it failed to surprise him. Exhausted firemen clung to the gurney's running boards, wearing bizarre rubber masks with gleaming eyepieces and accordioned breathing tubes. Mallory dearly wished for such a mask himself, for his eyes were misting so painfully now that he squinted like a pantomime pirate, but he tramped on. Aldgate became Fenchurch, then Lombard, then Poultry Street, and still he was miles from his goal, if the Palace of Paleontology could be said to be one. His head pounded and swam with the sullen lees of bad whiskey and worse air, and he seemed to be nearer the Thames now, for a damp and viscous taint arose that sickened him. On Cheapside, a city omnibus had been toppled on its side and set afire with its own boiler coals. Every window in it had been shattered, and it had burnt to a blackened husk. Mallory hoped no one had died inside it. The smoking wreckage stank too fiercely for him to want to look more closely. There were people in the churchyard of St. Paul's. The air seemed somewhat clearer there, for the dome was visible, and a large crowd of men and boys had collected among the churchyard trees. Unaccountably, they seemed in the highest spirits. Mallory perceived, to his astonishment, that they were brazenly tossing dice on the very steps of Wren's masterpiece. A little farther on, and Cheapside itself was blocked by scattered crowds of eager and determined gamblers. Fairy rings of rascals had sprouted left and right from the very pavement, men kneeling to guard their mounting stakes of coins and paper money. Eager leaders in mischief, tough, squint-eyed cockneys who seemed to have leapt whole from the coagulated stink of London, cried aloud, hoarsely, like patterers, as Mallory passed. "A shilling to open! Who'll shoot? Who will shoot, my lads?" From the scattered rings came cries of triumph at winning, angry groans muffled by masks. For each man boldly gambling, there were three who timidly watched. A carnival attraction, it seemed, a stinking and criminal carnival, but a London lark, nonetheless. There were no police in sight, no authority, no decency. Mallory edged warily through the thin, excited crowd, a cautious hand on the butt of the sailor's pistol. In an alley, two masked men booted a third, then relieved him of his watch and wallet. A crowd of at least a dozen watched the sight with only mild interest. These Londoners were like a gas, thought Mallory, like a cloud of minute atomies. The bonds of society broken, they had simply flown apart, like the perfectly elastic, gassy spheres in Boyle's Laws of Physics. Most of them looked respectable enough by their dress. They were merely reckless now, stripped by chaos to a moral vacuity. Most of them, Mallory thought, had never seen any event remotely like this one. They had no proper standards left for judgment or comparison. They had become puppets of base impulse. Like the Cheyenne tribesmen of Wyoming, dancing in the devil's grip of drink, the goodmen of civilized London had surrendered themselves to primitive madness, and by the patent look of surprised bliss on their shining faces, Mallory perceived that they enjoyed it. They enjoyed it very greatly indeed. It was exultation to them, a wicked freedom more perfect and desirable than any they had ever known. Along the edge of the crowd, a line of gaudy handbills had been newly slapped up across a formerly sacrosanct brick wall of Paternoster Row. They were adverts of the cheapest and most ubiquitous kind, the sort that pursued the eye all over London. Professor Renborn's magnetic headache pills, Beardsley's shredded codfish, McKesson and Robin's tartar lysine, Arnica tooth soap, and some theatrical prints. Madame Scapiglioni at the Savile House in Leicester Square, a Vauxhall Pan-Melodium Symphony, events, Mallory thought, that would surely never come off, and indeed the sheets had been posted with a careless haste that had badly wrinkled the paper. Fresh glue dripped from beneath the bills in rivulets of white ooze, a sight that perturbed Mallory in a way he could not define. But slapped amid these mundane bills, as if it belonged there by right, was a great 3-sheet broadside, a thing the size of a horse blanket, engine-printed, rumpled in the hasty plastering. Indeed, its very ink seemed still damp. A mad thing. Mallory stopped dead before it, stricken by its crude bizarrity. It had been done in 3 colors, scarlet, black, and an ugly grayish pink that seemed a muddle of the two. A scarlet blindfolded woman, a goddess of justice, in a blurry scarlet toga brandished a scarlet sword labeled Lud over the pinkish-gray heads of 2 very crudely rendered figures, a man and a woman depicted in busts, a king and queen, Lord and Lady Byron, perhaps? The scarlet goddess trampled the midsection of a large 2-headed snake, or scaly dragon, its writhing body labeled Merit Lordship. Behind the scarlet woman, the skyline of London was vigorously aflame in scarlet tongues of fire, while the sky all about the various demented figures was full of stylized scrolls of thick black cloud. 3 men, clergymen or savants, apparently, dangled from a gallows in the upper right-hand corner, and in the upper left, a confused mass of ill-formed, gesticulating figures waved flags and Jacobin pikes, advancing toward some unknown goal under the bearded star of a comet. And this was not the half of it. Mallory rubbed at his aching eyes. The vast rectangular sheet seethed with smaller images like a billiard table littered with random pool balls. Here a dwarfish wind god blew out a cloud labeled Pestilence. There a cannon shell, or bomb, exploded in stylized, spiky fragments, small black misshapen imps being flung aside by the blast. A coffin, heaped with flowers, held a noose atop it. A nude woman crouched at the feet of a monster, a well-dressed man with the head of a reptile. A tiny praying man in epaulette stood on a gallows, while the hangman, a little fellow with a hood and his sleeves rolled up, gestured brusquely at the noose. More of the smudgy smoke clouds, flung onto the image like mud, connected the whole business like the dough of a fruitcake. And there was text, too, near the bottom, a title in large, smudgy engine type. The 7 Curses of the Whore of Babylondon. Babylondon? Baby what? What curses? And why 7? The sheet seemed flung together out of random chunks of engine imagery. Mallory knew that modern printers had special printer's punch cards, clacked up to print specific blocky pictures, much like the cheap woodcut blocks on old murder ballads. In the engine work of the catchpenny prints, you might see the same hackneyed picture 100 times. But here the colors were hideous, the images jammed hither and thither in apparent madness. And worst of all, the broadsheet seemed to be attempting to express something, in however halting and convulsive a way, that was simply and truly unspeakable. "Be ye talking to me?" demanded a man next to Mallory. Mallory jumped a bit, startled. "Nothing," he muttered. The man loomed nearer at Mallory's shoulder, a very tall, gaunt cockney, with lank, filthy yellow hair under a towering stovepipe hat. He was drunk, for his eyes were maddened and bright. His face was masked securely in polka-dot fabric. His dirty clothes were near rags, save the shoes, which were stolen and spanking new. The cockney reeked with days of unwashed sweat, the stink of dereliction, madness. He squinted hard at the broadsheet, then at Mallory again. "Friends of yours, squire?" "No," Mallory said. "Tell me what it means," the cockney insisted. "I heard you were talking over it. You do know, don't you?" The man's sharp voice trembled, and when he looked from the poster to Mallory again, the bright accusing eyes above the mask seemed kindled with animal hate. "Get away from me," Mallory shouted. "Blaspheming Christ the Savior," the tall man screeched, his voice rising, his gnarled hands kneading the air. "Christ's holy blood, what washed us free of sin!" He reached for Mallory. Mallory knocked the grasping hand away. "Kill him," an anonymous voice suggested eagerly. The gloating words charged the sullen air like a Leyden jar. Suddenly, Mallory and his opponent were in the midst of a crowd, no longer random particles, but the focus of real trouble. The tall Cockney, half-shoved perhaps, stumbled into Mallory. Mallory doubled him up with a punch to the breadbasket. Someone screamed then, a high, hilarious, blood-curdling sound. A flung wad of mud missed Mallory's head and splattered against the picture. As if this were a signal, there was a sudden blinding melee of shrieks, thudding bodies, flung punches. Mallory, shoving, swearing, dancing on his trampled feet, yanked the revolver from his waistband, pointed it in the air, and squeezed the trigger. Nothing. An elbow caught him hard in the ribs. He cocked the hammer with his thumb, squeezed again. The report was shocking, deafening. In a split second, the melee was melting away from Mallory, men falling, billowing, scrambling away headlong on hands and knees in their utter beast-like eagerness to flee. Men were trampled before his eyes. Mallory stood for an instant, his jaw dropping in astonishment within his cambric mask, the gun still poised overhead. Then a bolt of good sense struck him. He retreated. He tried to jam the pistol back into his waistband as he ran, but saw with shocked alarm that the hammer was cocked again, the gun ready to fire at any touch of the trigger. He dangled the treacherous thing at arm's length as he fled. At length he stopped, coughing bitterly. From behind him, wrapped in the roiling obscurity of fog, came scattered pistol shots and bestial cries of rage, derision, glee. "Dear Christ," Mallory muttered, and peered at the mechanism. The devilish thing had cocked itself automatically, channeling part of the powder blast into the piston beneath the barrel, which shunted the grooved cylinder back against the stationary ratchet, spinning the next round into place and kicking the hammer back. Mallory hooked both thumbs over the hammer and worked at the trigger with care until he could close the mechanism. He slid the pistol back into his waistband. He had not outrun the line of pasted handbills. They still ranged before him, apparently inexhaustible in number, slapped up one after another in a ragged line. He followed them, through a street now seemingly empty. From somewhere came a distant crash of glass and whoops of boyish laughter. "Secret keys made cheaply," said a plastered bill. "Handsome waterproofs for India and the colonies. Apprentice chemists and druggists wanted." Ahead he heard the quiet pop of slow hooves, the squeak of an axle. Emerging from the mist, then, the bill sticker's van, a tall black wagon, its towering sides mounted with great shouting billboards. A masked fellow in a loose gray raincoat was shoving a plastered bill against the wall. The wall was protected by a tall iron fence some 5 feet distant from the brick, but this bothered the sticker man not at all, for he had a specialized roller device on a kind of long broom handle. Mallory stepped nearer to watch. The bill sticker did not look up, having reached a crucial moment of his work. The bill itself, which was tightly wrapped about a black rubber roller, was pressed and rolled, bottom upward, against the wall. The sticker, at the same moment, deftly squeezing a hand piston on the shaft of his device, which squirted out a gruelly mess of paste from twin spigots bracketed to the roller's ends. Another swipe downward to complete the pasting, and it was done. The van moved on. Mallory stepped closer and examined the bill, which extolled and depicted in an engine cut the beautifying effects of Colgate's clear complexion soap. The sticker man and his van moved on. Mallory followed it. The sticker man noticed Mallory's attention, and it seemed to rattle him a bit, for he muttered something at the driver, and the van moved on a good ways. Mallory followed discreetly. The van stopped now at a corner of Fleet Street, where the hoardings bore, by old tradition, the great shouting bills of the city's newspapers. But a bill was boldly slapped across the face of the Morning Clarion, and then another, and another. More theatrical print this time. Dr. Benet of Paris was to lecture on the therapeutic value of aquatic sleep. The Chautauqua Society of the Susquehanna Phalanstery would present a symposium on the social philosophy of the late Dr. Coleridge, and a scientific lecture with kinotropy would be presented by Dr. Edward Mallory. Mallory halted, grinning behind his mask. Edward Mallory. He had to admit that the name looked very well in 80-point engine Gothic. It was a great pity that the speech could not come off, but clearly Huxley, or likely one of his staff men, had placed the order for bills with promptness, and there had been no cancellation. A shame, Mallory thought, gazing at the departing bill van with a new proprietorial fondness. Edward Mallory. He would have liked to keep the bill as a souvenir, and thought indeed of peeling it loose, but the gobbets of paste dissuaded him. He looked more closely, hoping to commit the text to memory. At a second glance, the printing job was not all it might have been, for the black lettering had here and there smudgy rims of scarlet, as if the printing pens had been soaked in red ink and not properly clean. The Museum of Practical Geology, Jermyn Street, has the honor to present to the London public for two shows only Dr. Edward Mallory. Dr. Mallory, FRS, FRGS, will present the thrilling history of his discovery of the famous Land Leviathan in Savage, Wyoming, his theories of its milieu, habits, and sustenance, his encounters with the savage Cheyenne Indians, detailing with this the melancholy and hideous murder of his closest rival, the late Professor Rudwich, secrets of professional gambling, specifically that of ratting dens, to be imparted to those eager to know the technique of odds-making, to be followed by a most luscious Dance of the Seven Veils, to be performed by the several Mrs. Mallory, giving a frank account of their several introductions to the art of love. Only gentlemen will be admitted. Price 2 shillings 6 pence. Show to be accompanied by the advanced kinotropy of Mr. Keats, K-E-E-T-S. Mallory gritted his teeth and broke into a sprint. He ran ahead of the van, which was moving on at foot pace, and seized the bridle of the mule two-handed. The animal stopped with a snort and a stumble. Its filthy head was swaddled in a canvas mask adapted from a feed bag. The coachman emitted a yelp from behind a smut-stained muffler. He leapt down from his wooden seat to land with a stagger, waving a hickory cudgel. "Hello! Leave off!" he cried. "Bar that nonsense, Davy, and hook it sharp!" His voice trailed off as he took Mallory's measure, slapping the cudgel against his calloused palm with an attempt at menace. The second bill sticker rushed up from behind the van to join his friend, brandishing his long-handled rig like a pitchfork. "Hedge off, mister," the coachman suggested. "We ain't doing you no harm." "You most certainly are," Mallory bellowed. "Where did you rascals obtain those bills? Tell me at once." The taller man defiantly shook the paste-smeared roller of his rig at Mallory's face. "London's wide open today. You want to make a fight of where we dab our paper, then just you try us." One of the large advert boards on the side of the van swung open suddenly, on squealing brass hinges. A carriage door, it seemed, for a small, stout, balding man hopped through it, from within the van. He wore a neat red shooting coat and checkered trousers tucked into patent leather walking boots. He was bareheaded, his round, red-cheeked face was not masked, and to Mallory's astonishment he was smoking a large, vilely fuming pipe. "What's all this, then?" he inquired mildly. "A ruffian, sir," the coachman declared. "Some villain bullyrock sent by Turkey Legs."
"What, all by hisself?" the stout man said, with a quizzical arch of his brows. "That don't seem right."
He looked Mallory up and down.
"You know who I am, son?"
"No," Mallory said. "Who are you?"
"I'm the gent they call the King of the Bill Stickers, my boy. If you don't know that fact, you must be mighty green at this business."
"I'm not in your business. I, sir, am Dr. Edward Mallory."
The stout man folded his arms and rocked a bit on his boot heel.
"So?"
"You just pasted up a bill that grossly libeled me."
"Oh," said the king. "So that's your bellyache, is it?"
He grinned in evident relief.
Well, that's nothing to do with me, Dr. Edward Mallory. I just paste them. I don't print them. I ain't liable. So you're not putting up any more of those damnable libel sheets, Mallory said. I want all the rest of them, and I demand to know where you obtained them. The king quieted his two bristling henchmen with a regal move of his hand. I'm a very busy man, Dr. Mallory. If you'd care to step up in my van and talk to me like a reasonable gentleman, then perhaps I'll listen. But I've no time for any bluster or threats. He fixed Mallory with a sharp squint of his little blue eyes. Well, Mallory blurted, taken aback. Though he knew he was in the right, the king's quiet retort had taken the steam out of his indignation. He felt rather foolish of a sudden, and rather out of his element somehow. Surely, he muttered. Very well. Fair enough. Tom, Jemmy, let's back to work. The king clambered deftly into his van. Mallory, after a moment's hesitation, followed him, heaving himself up into the body of the oddly made carriage. There were no seats inside. The flooring from wall to wall was dimpled and buttoned with thick maroon cushioning, like a Turkish ottoman. Planted pigeonholes of varnished wood lined the walls, stuffed with tightly rolled bills. A large trap door in the ceiling had been flung open, admitting a gloomy light. It stank direly of paste and cheap black shag tobacco. The king sprawled at his ease, propping himself on a fat tufted pillow. The mule brayed under the driver's whip crack, and the van lurched into sluggish, squeaking motion. Gin and water, the king offered, opening a cabinet. Plain water, if you please, Mallory said. Straight water it is. The king poured from a pottery canteen into a tin mug. Mallory tugged his frayed mask down below his chin and drank with an aching thirst. The king gave Mallory a second round and then a third. Perhaps a tasty squeeze of lemon with that. The king winked. I do hope you know your limit. Mallory cleared his slimy throat. Very decent of you. His face felt oddly naked without the mask, and this show of civility within the king's van, together with its chemical stink of glue, almost worse than the Thames, had quite dizzied him. I regret it if I, seemed a bit sharp earlier. Well, it's the lads, you know, said the king with generous tact. A cove must stand ready to handle his fists in the bill-sticking business. Just yesterday my boys had to lay it on pretty brisk with old Turkey Legs and his lads over a matter of sticking space within Trafalgar Square. The king sniffed in disdain. I've had certain sharp troubles of my own during this emergency, Mallory said hoarsely. But basically I'm a reasonable man, sir. Very rational. Not the sort who looks for trouble. You mustn't think that. The king nodded sagely. I've never yet known Turkey Legs to hire any scholar as a bully rock. By your dress and manner, I take you to be a savant, sir. You have a sharp eye. I like to think so, the king allowed. So, now that we have that matter clear, perhaps you'll informate me concerning this grievance you seem to hold. Those bills you've pasted are forgeries, Mallory said, and libelous. They're certainly not legal. As I explained before, that's none of my affair, the king said. Let me tell you a few facts of commerce, straight out. For dabbing up 100 double-crown sheets, I expect to make £1.1, which is to say 2/6 of a penny per sheet. Say 3 pence rounded out. Now, if you should care to purchase certain of my bills at that rate, I might be ready to talk business. Where are they? Mallory said. If you'd care to have a look among the cubby holes for the items in question, I will oblige you. When the crew had stopped to paste more bills, Mallory began to sort through the stock. The bills were tightly wrapped in neat, thick, perforated scrolls, as dense and hefty as bludgeons. The king passed a scroll through the trapdoor to the driver. Then he peaceably tapped out the dottle of his meerschaum, refilled it from a twist of coarse paper, and lit it with a German tinderbox.
He blew a cloud of foulness with every appearance of satisfaction.
"Here they are," Mallory said. He peeled the outermost sheet from the roll and flapped it out within the van. "Have a look at this abomination, will you? It looks quite splendid at first, but the text is obscenely outrageous. Standard roller 40. That'll be 6 shillings even."
"Read here," Mallory said, "where it as much as accuses me of murder."
The king politely turned his eyes upon the sheet. His lips moved as he puzzled painfully over the title.
"My lorry," he said at length.
"One of your lorry shows, is it?"
"Mallory, that's my name."
"It's a demi-sheet theatrical, no illos," the king said. "Bit smudgy."
"Oh, yes, I remember these."
He sighed, smoke. "I might have known no good would come of taking this confinement. Mind you, the rascal paid in advance, though."
"Who? Whom?"
"Down in Limehouse, in the West India docks," the king said. "A deal of commotion in that locale, Dr. Mallory. Rascals slapping brand new bills up all over every wall and hoarding in sight, since yesterday. My boys were inclined to make a bit of trouble over that encroachment till Captain Swing, that's what he calls himself, saw fit to engage our services."
Mallory's armpits prickled with sweat.
"Captain Swing, is it?"
"Sporting fellow of some kind, to judge by his dress," the king said cheerfully. "Short, red-headed, squinty. Had a bump on his head just here. Crazy as a bedbug, I should say. He was polite enough, though, not proposing to make any trouble for the bill-sticking trade once customary matters was explained to him. And he had him a sight of ready money."
"I know that man," Mallory said, his voice trembling. "He's a violent Luddite conspirator. He may be the most dangerous man in England."
"You don't say," the king grunted.
"He's a dire threat to public safety."
"Fellow didn't look like much," the king said. "Funny little duck, wore spectacles and talked to himself."
"The man is an enemy of the realm, a dark lanternist of the most sinister description."
"I don't much hold with politics myself," said the king, leaning back quite at his ease. "The Bill-Sticking Regulatory Act, now that's politics for you, a doltish business. That blasted act is mighty stiff regarding where bills may be posted. Let me tell you, Dr. Mallory, I personally know the member that got that act passed in Parliament, for I was hired for his election campaign. He didn't mind where his bills went. It was all quite right enough so long as they was his bills."
"My God," Mallory broke in, "the thought of that evil man, loose in London, with money from God only knows what source, fomenting riot and rebellion during a public emergency, and in control of an engine-driven press. It's nightmarish, horrible."
"Pray don't fash yourself, Dr. Mallory," the king chided gently. "My dear old father, rest his soul, used to tell me, when all about you are losing their heads, son, just remember, there are still 20 shillings in a pound."
"That's as may be," Mallory said, "but
my dear dad stuck bills in the time of troubles, back in the 1930s when the cavalry charged on the working people, and old hooky-nose Wellington got hisself blown to flinders. Hard times indeed, sir, much harder than soft modern days with this trifling stink. Call this an emergency? Why, I call it opportunity, and have done with it."
"You don't seem to grasp the urgency of the crisis," Mallory said.
"The time of troubles. Now that was when they printed the first 4-sheet double crowns. The Tory government used to pay my old dad. My dad was beadle and bill sticker to the parish of St. Andrews, Holborn, to blackwash radical bills. He had to hire women to do it. There was so much call for the job. He'd blackwash rad bills by day and stick up new ones by night. There's a deal of fine opportunity in your times of revolution."
Mallory sighed.
"My dad invented the device we call the patent extendable dabbing joint, to which I myself have made a number of mechanical improvements. It serves to stick bills to the undersides of bridges for the water trade. We are an entrepreneurial line in my family, sir, not easily put out of countenance."
A lot of good all that will do you when London's reduced to ashes,
Mallory said.
Why, you're helping the scoundrel in his anarchistic plottings.
I should say you have that straight backwards, Dr. Mallory, the king said with an odd little chuckle. Last I saw, the fellow was paying his money into my pocket, and not vice versa. Now that I think on it, he's consigned a number of bills to my safekeeping, right along the top row here.
The king stood, yanked the documents down, cast them onto his padded floor.
You see, sir, it don't really matter a hang what nonsense is blithered and babbled on these bills. The secret truth is that bills is endless by their very nature, regular as the tides in the Thames, or the smoke of London. London's true sons call London the smoke, you know. She's an eternal city, like your Jerusalem, or Rome, or some would say Satan's pandemonium. You don't see the king of the bill-stickers worrying for smoky London, do you? Not a bit of it.
But the people have fled.
A passing foolishness. They'll all be back, said the king with sublime confidence. Why, they have no place else to go. This is the center of the world, sir.
Mallory fell silent. So, sir, proclaimed the king, if you was to take my advice, you'd spend 6 shillings on that roll of bills you're clutching. Why, for 1 pound even, I'll toss in these other misprinted bills of our friend Captain Swings. 20 simple shillings, sir, and you may leave these streets and rest at home in peace and quiet.
Some of these bills have already been posted, Mallory said. I could have the lads blackwash 'em, or paste 'em over, anyhow, the king mused. If you was willing to make it worth their while, of course.
Would that put an end to the matter? Said Mallory, reaching for his pocketbook.
I doubt it. A better end than any you can make with that pistol I see peeping from your trouser band, said the king. That is an item which cannot do a gentleman and scholar any credit.
Mallory said nothing.
Heed my counsel, Dr. Mallory, and put that gun away before you do yourself a mischief. I do believe you might have hurt one of my lads if I hadn't spied that gun through my peephole and stepped out to set things right. Go home, sir, and cool your head.
Why aren't you at home, if you truly mean that advice? Mallory said.
Why, this is my home, sir, said the king. He tucked Mallory's money into his shooting jacket. On pleasant days, my old woman and I take our tea in here and talk about old times, and walls, and embankments, and hoardings.
I have no home in London, and in any case, business calls me to Kensington, Mallory said.
That's a distance, Dr. Mallory.
Yes, it is, Mallory said, with a tug at his beard. But it strikes me that there are any number of museums and savant palaces in Kensington which have never been touched by advert paper.
Really, mused the king. Do tell.
Mallory bade the king farewell a good mile from the Palace of Paleontology. He was unable to bear the fumes of glue any longer, and the van's lurching had made him badly seasick. He staggered off with the heavy scrolls of libelous and anarchic bills bundled awkwardly in his sweating grip. Behind him, Jimmy and Tom set to eager glue-slapping on the virgin bricks of the Palace of Political Economy. Mallory propped the rolled bills against an ornate lamppost and re-knotted his cloth mask over nose and mouth. His head spun evilly. Perhaps, he thought, that sticking paste had had a bit of arsenic in it, or the ink some potent nauseous coal derivative, for he felt poisoned and weak in his very marrow. When he juggled up the bills again, their paper wrinkled in his sweating hands like the peeling skin of a drowned man. He had, it seemed, frustrated a lashing bite of the tout's hydra-headed devilment, but this minor triumph seemed wretchedly small when matched against the villain's seemingly endless reservoirs of wicked ingenuity. Mallory was stumbling in darkness, while torn at will by invisible fangs. And yet Mallory had discovered a crucial piece of evidence. The tout was gone to earth in the West India docks. To be so close to a chance to grapple with the scoundrel, and yet so far, it was enough to madden a man. Mallory stumbled badly on a slick lump of horse dung, then swung the scrolls up onto his right shoulder in an unstable heap. It was a useless fantasy to imagine confronting the tout, alone, unaided, while the man was miles away, back across the chaos of London. Mallory had almost reached the palace now, and it had taken well-nigh all he had to manage the trick of it. He forced himself to concentrate on the matters at hand. He would haul the wretched bills to the palace safety box. They might prove useful as evidence some day, and they could take the place of Madeline's wedding clock. He would take up the clock, he would find a way to flee this cursed London, and he would rejoin his family, as he should have done. In Green Sussex, in the bosom of the good old Clawney, there would be quiet and sense and safety. The gears of his life would begin to mesh once more in order. Mallory lost his grip on the rolls of paper, and they cascaded violently to the tarmac, one of them hitting him a smart blow across the shins as it bounded free. He gathered them up, groaning, and tried the other shoulder. In the rancid mists down Knightsbridge, a procession of some kind was moving steadily across the road. Ghost-like, blurred by distance and the stink, they appeared to be military gurneys, the squat-treaded monsters of the Crimean War. Fog muffled a heavy chugging and the faint repeated clank of jointed iron. One after another they passed, while Mallory peered forward, standing quite still and gripping his burden. Each gurney hauled a linked, articulated caisson. These wains appeared to be canvas-shrouded cannon, with men, foot soldiers in canvas-colored drab, clustered atop the cannons like barnacles, with a sea-urchin bristle of bayoneted rifles. At least a dozen war gurneys, possible a score. Mallory rubbed his aching eyes in puzzled disbelief. At Brompton Concourse he saw a trio of masked and hatted figures scamper off with light-foot tread from a broken doorway, but no one offered trouble to him. Some civil authority had erected sawhorses at the gate of the Palace of Paleontology, but the barricades were not manned. It was a simple matter to slip past them and up the fog-slick stone stairs to the main entrance. The palace's great double doors were thickly curtained in a protective shroud of wet canvas, hung from the brick archway down to the very flagstone. The thick, damp fabric smelled sharply of chloride of lime. Behind the canvas, the palace doors were slightly ajar. Mallory eased his way inside. Servants were draping the furniture of lobby and drawing room with thin white sheets of muslin. Others, a peculiar crowd of them, swept and mopped and dabbled earnestly at the cornices with long jointed feather dusters. London women and a large number of children of all ages bustled about wearing borrowed palace cleaning aprons, looking anxious but vaguely exalted. Mallory realized at length that these strangers must be the families of the palace staff, come to seek shelter and security within the grandest public building known to them. And someone, Kelly the major domo, presumably, with help from whatever savants still remained on the premises, had pluckily organized the refugees. Mallory strode toward the lobby desk, lugging his paper burden. These were sturdy working-class folk, he realized. Their stations might be humble, but they were Britons through and through. They were not daunted. They had rallied in instinctive defense of their scientific institutions and the civil values of law and property. He realized, with a heart-lifting wash of patriotic relief, that the lurching madness of chaos had reached its limit. Within the faltering maelstrom, a nucleation of spontaneous order had arisen. Now, like a cloudy muck resolving into crystals, everything would change. Mallory flung his hated burden behind the deserted counter of the lobby desk. In one corner, a telegraph was clacking fitfully, new punch tape spooling by fits and starts upon the floor. Mallory observed this small but significant miracle and sighed, like a diver whose head has broken water. The palace air was sharp with disinfectant, but blissfully breathable. Mallory stripped the filthy mask from his face and stuffed it in his pocket. Somewhere in this blessed shelter, he thought, there was food to be had. Perhaps a wash basin and soap and sulfurated powder for the fleas that had been creeping about his waistband since morning. Eggs, ham, restorative wine, postage stamps, laundresses, shoe blacking, the whole miraculous concatenated network of civilization. A stranger came marching toward Mallory across the lobby floor, a British soldier, an artillery subaltern, in elegant dress gear. He wore a double-breasted blue coatee, bright with chevrons, brass buttons, and gold-braided epaulets. His sleek trousers had a red military stripe. He wore a round, gold-laced forage cap and a buttoned pistol holster at his neat white waist belt. With his shoulders square, spine straight, and head high, this handsome young man approached with a stern look of purpose. Mallory straightened quickly, taken aback, even vaguely shamed, to compare his rumpled, sweat-stained civilian garb to this crisp military paragon. Then, with a leap of surprise, happy recognition dawned. "Brian!" Mallory shouted. "Brian, boy!" The soldier quickened his pace. "Ned? Why, it is you, ain't it?" said Mallory's brother, a tender smile parting his new Crimean beard. He seized Mallory's hand in both his own and shook it heartily with a solid strength. Mallory noted with surprise and pleasure that military discipline and scientific diet had put inches and pounds on the lad. Brian Mallory, the family's sixth-born child, had often seemed a bit quiet and timid, but now Mallory's little brother stood a good 6'4" in his military boots and had the look in his creased blue eyes of a man who had seen the world. "We've been a-waiting for you, Ned," Brian told him. His bold voice had slipped a bit, by some old habit, into the remembered tone of their childhood. For Mallory, it was a plaintive echo from deep memory, the demands of a crowd of little children upon their eldest brother. Somehow this familiar call, far from tiring or burdening Mallory, rallied him immediately into a mental second wind. Confusion vanished like a mist, and he felt stronger, more capable. The very presence of young Brian had recalled him to himself. "Damn me, but it's good to see you," Mallory blurted. "It's good you're back at last," Brian said. "We heard tale of a fire in your room, and you vanished into London, none knew where. That put me and Tom in a very mismaze." "Tom is here too, eh?" "We both come into London in Tom's little gurney," Brian told him. His face fell. "With dire news, Ned, and no ways to tell it save to your face." "What is it?" Mallory said, bracing himself. Is it Dad?" "No, Ned. Dad's all right, or right as he ever is these days. It is poor Madeline." Mallory groaned. "Not the bride-to-be. What is it now?" "Well, it's to do with my mate, Jerry Rawling," Brian muttered, squaring his epauletted shoulders with a look of embarrassed pain. "Jerry wanted to do right by our Madeline, Ned, for he always talked of her, and lived very clean for her sake. But he's received such a letter at home, Ned, such a foul and dreadful thing. It quite knocked the heart out of him." "What letter, for God's sake?" "Well, it warn't signed, except one who knows. But the writer knew so much about us, the family, I mean, all our littlest doings, and said that Madeline had been unchaste, except in rougher words." Mallory felt a surge of hot fury rush to his face. "I understand," he said in a quiet, choked voice. "Go on." "Well, their engagement is broken, as you might guess. Poor Maddie has the vapors like she's never had them before. She liked to do herself an injury, and does nothing now but sit alone in the kitchen and cry rivers." Mallory was silent, his mind grating over Brian's information. "I've been away a deal of time, in India and Crimea," Brian said in a low, halting voice. "I don't know how matters stand exactly. Tell me true. You don't think there could be aught to what that wicked gossip told to Jerry, do you?" "What? Our own Madeline? My God, Brian. She's a Mallory girl." Mallory slammed his fist on the counter. "No, it is slander. It's a foul, deliberate attack on the honor of our family."
"How?
Why would anyone do such a thing to us, Ned?
Asked Brian, with a strange look of plaintive fury. I know why it was done, and I know the villain who did it.
Brian's eyes went wide. You do?
Yes. He is the fellow who burnt my rooms, and I know where he is hiding at this very moment.
Brian gazed at him in astonished silence. I made an enemy of him, in a dark affair of state, Mallory said, measuring his words. I'm a man of some influence now, Brian, and I've uncovered the kind of secret silent plottings that a man like yourself, an honest soldier of the crown, could scarcely credit.
Brian shook his head slowly. I've seen pagan vileness done in India to make strong men sick, he said. But to see it done in England is more than I can bear.
Brian tugged at his whiskers, a gesture Mallory found oddly familiar.
I knew it was right to come to you, Ned. You always seem to see straight through things, the way none else can. Say on, then. What shall we do about this horrid business? What can we do?
That pistol in your holster, is it in working order?
Brian's eyes brightened.
Truth to tell, 'tisn't regulation. A war trophy, gotten off a dead Tsarist officer.
He began to unlatch his holster flap. Mallory shook his head quickly, looking about the lobby. You're not afraid to use your pistol, if you have to do so.
Afraid? Brian said.
If you aren't a civilian, Ned, I might take that question ill.
Mallory stared at him. Brian met his eyes boldly.
It's for the family, ain't it? That's what we fought the Ruskies for the sake of the folks at home.
Where is Thomas?
He's eating in the... Well, I'll show you.
Brian led the way into the palace saloon. The scholarly precincts were crowded with babbling, raucous diners, working folk mostly, forking up potatoes off the palace china as if famished. Young Tom Mallory, dressed rather flash in a short linen coat and checked trousers, sat at table with a companion over the remains of fried fish and lemonade. The other man was Ebenezer Fraser.
Ned, cried Tom, I knew you'd come.
He rose and seized another chair.
Sit down with us, sit down. Your friend Mr. Fraser here has been kind enough to buy us lunch.
And how are you, Dr. Mallory? Fraser inquired glumly.
A bit fatigued, Mallory told him, sitting. But nothing a bite of food and a hucklebuff wouldn't set to rights. How are you, Fraser? Quite recovered, I hope.
He lowered his voice. And what line of clever nonsense have you been telling my poor brothers, pray?
Fraser said nothing.
Sergeant Fraser's a London policeman, Mallory said, of the dark lantern variety.
Truly?
Tom blurted, alarmed. A waiter worked his way toward the table, one of the regular staff, looking harried and apologetic.
Dr. Mallory, the palace larder's a bit low, sir. Simple fish and taters would be best, sir, if you don't mind it.
That will be fine. And if you could mix a hucklebuff... Well, never mind. Bring me coffee, strong and black.
Fraser watched the waiter leave with melancholy patience.
You must have had a lively night, Fraser remarked, when the man was out of earshot. Both Tom and Brian were watching Fraser with a new, half-resentful suspicion.
I have discovered that the tout, Captain Swing, that is, has gone to earth in the West India docks, Mallory said. He's attempting to incite a general insurrection.
Fraser's lips tightened. He has an engine printing press and a rabble of Confederates. He's printing seditious documents by the scores and hundreds. I confiscated a few specimens this morning. Obscene, libelous, Luddite filth.
You've been industrious.
Mallory snorted. I'll shortly be a deal busier yet, Fraser. I mean to hunt the wretch down directly and put a sharp end to this.
Brian leaned forward.
It was this Captain Swing who wrote that lying slander against our Maddie, then, was it?
Yes.
Tom sat up straight in his chair with a flush of excitement.
West India Docks. Where's that, then?
Down on the Limehouse Reach, clear across London, Fraser said.
That don't matter a hang, Tom said quickly. I've my Zephyr.
Mallory was startled. You brought the Brotherhood's racer?
Tom shook his head. Not that old banger, Ned, but the latest model. She's a spanking new little beauty, sitting in your palace stables. Took us all the way from Sussex in a morning, and would have gone faster yet if I hadn't had a coal wain hitched to her.
He laughed.
We can go wherever we like.
Let's not lose our heads, gentlemen, Fraser warned. They fell unwillingly silent for a moment as the waiter deftly set Mallory's food before him. The sight of fried plaice and sliced potatoes made Mallory's stomach knot with a famished pang. We are free British subjects and may go as we please, Mallory said firmly, then seized his silverware and fell to at once. I can only call that foolish, said Fraser. Riotous mobs are roaming the streets, and the man you seek is as cunning as an adder. Mallory grunted derisively. Fraser was dour. Dr. Mallory, it is my duty to see that you don't come to harm. We can't have you stirring up dangerous serpent nests in the vilest slums in London. Mallory gulped hot coffee. You know that he means to destroy me, he told Fraser, locking eyes with him. If I don't finish him now, while I've the chance, he'll slowly peck me into pieces. There's not a dashed thing you can do that can protect me. This man is not like you and I, Fraser. He is beyond the pale. The stakes are life and death. It is him or me. You know that is the truth. Fraser, struck by Mallory's argument, looked shaken. Tom and Brian, even more alarmed at this new revelation of the depth of their troubles, glanced at one another in confusion, then turned to glare angrily at Fraser. Fraser spoke reluctantly. Let's not act hastily. Once the fog lifts and law and order have returned, Captain Swing lives within a fog that never lifts, Mallory said. Brian broke in with a swipe of his gilded sleeve. I see no point in this, Mr. Fraser. You have deliberately deceived my brother Thomas and myself. I can put no credit in any of your counsel. Brian's right, said Tom. He regarded Fraser with a mingled scorn and wonder. This man claimed he was a friend of yours, Ned, and got me and Brian to talking free and easy about you. Now he's a-trying to order us about. Tom shook his clenched fist, sinewy and work-hardened. I mean to teach this Captain Swing a sharp lesson. If I need to start with you, Mr. Fraser, then I stand a-ready. Softly now, lads, Mallory told his brothers. Other diners nearby had begun to stare. Mallory deliberately wiped his mouth with a napkin. Fortune favors us, Mr. Fraser, he said quietly. I have acquired a pistol, and young Brian is also armed. Oh, dear, said Fraser. I'm not afraid of Swing, Mallory told him. Remember, I knocked him flat at the Derby. Face to face, he's naught but a yellow cur. He is at the docks, Mallory, Fraser said. Do you think you're going to waltz and poker through a riot in the hardest part of London? We Mallory lads aren't fancy jacks from any dancing academy, Mallory told the policeman. Do you think the London poor more frightful to face than Wyoming savages? Actually, yes, Fraser said slowly. Considerably worse, I should judge. Oh, for heaven's sake, Fraser, don't waste our time with this trifling. We must grapple once and for all with this slippery phantom, and a better chance will never come. In the name of sanity and justice, put an end to your useless, officious grizzling. Fraser sighed. And suppose, in this brave expedition, that you are cunningly trapped and murdered, like your colleague Rudwick. What then? How would I answer to my superior? But now Brian fixed Fraser with a soldier's steely eye. Did you ever have a little sister, Mr. Fraser? Did you ever have to watch that girl's happiness shattered like a china cup, trampled by a monster? And with her broken heart, the honest heart of a Crimean hero, whose simple manly intention
was to make her his bride. Fraser groaned aloud.
Enough!
Brian leaned back, looking somewhat crestfallen at the interruption. Fraser smoothed his dark lapels with both hands.
It seems the fated time for risks, he admitted, with a lopsided shrug and a passing wince. I haven't had a bit of luck since I met you, Dr. Mallory, and I dare say I'm due for a change of fortune.
Suddenly his eyes glittered.
Who's to say that we might not bag the scoundrel, eh? Arrest him. He's clever, but four brave men might catch the nasty wretch with his guard down, whilst he swaggers about in poor-stricken London like some Jacobin prince.
Fraser scowled, his lean face twisting with genuine anger. It was an unexpectedly fearsome sight.
Fortune favors the brave, Brian said.
And God looks after fools, muttered Fraser.
He leaned forward intently, plucking his trouser legs from his bony knees.
This is no light matter, gentlemen. No lark for amateurs. This is dire work. We shall be taking the law, and our lives, and our honor, into our own hands. If it is to be done at all, it must be done in the strictest and most permanent secrecy.
Mallory, sensing victory, spoke up with an adroitness that surprised even himself.
My brothers and I respect your special expertise, Sergeant Fraser. If you will guide us toward justice, then we will gladly place ourselves at your command. You need never doubt our discretion or our resolve. The sacred honor of our own dear sister is at stake.
Tom and Brian seemed taken aback at this sudden change of tack, for they still distrusted Fraser, but Mallory's somber pledge brooked no objection from them. They followed his lead.
You'll never see me peaching, Tom declared. Not to my grave.
I should think the sworn word of a British soldier still accounts, Brian said.
Then we shall try the venture, Fraser said, with a wry look of fatalism.
I must get steam up in the Zephyr, Tom said, rising from his chair. Half an hour my little beauty takes from a cold start.
Mallory nodded. He would put every minute to good use. Outside the palace, washed, combed, and intimately dusty with flea powder, Mallory sought a lumpy purchase atop the Zephyr's wooden coal wing. The chugging little gurney had barely room for two men within its line-streamed tin shell. Tom and Fraser had taken those seats. They were arguing now over a London street map. Brian stamped out a rude nest within the wain's flabby canvas, stretched atop a diminishing heap of coal. They take a deal of shoveling, your modern gurneys, Brian observed with a stoic smile. He sat across from Mallory. Tom does take on about this precious machine of his, talked my ear off about Zephyrs, all the way from Lewis. The gurney and Wayne lurched into motion, the coal wain's wooden-spoked rubbered wheels turning with a rhythmic creak. They rolled down Kensington Road with a startling celerity. Brian brushed a flaming smokestack spark from his dapper coat sleeve.
You need a breathing mask, Mallory said, offering his brother one of the makeshift masks the ladies had sewn within the palace, a neatly stitched ribboned square of gingham, stuffed with cheap Confederate cotton.
Brian sniffed at the rushing air.
Ain't so bad.
Mallory knotted the ribbons of his own mask neatly behind his head.
My asthma will tell against your health, lad, in the long run.
This don't compare to the pong of an army transport boat, said Brian.
The absence of Fraser seemed to have relaxed him. There was something more of the Sussex lad about him, and less of the stern young subaltern.
Coaly fumes pouring out our engine room, Brian reminisced, and the lads tossing up their rations from the Mal de Mer right and left. We steamed through that new Frenchy canal in Suez, straight from Bombay. We lived in that bloody transport for weeks, rotten Egyptian heat, straight through to hard Crimean winter. If the cholera or the quartan fever didn't carry me off from that, then I needn't worry over any little mist in London.
Brian chuckled. I often thought of you in Canada, Mallory told his brother. You, with a 5-year enlistment and a war on.
But I knew you'd do the family proud, Brian. I knew you'd do your duty.
We Mallory lads are all over the world, Ned, said Brian, philosophically. His voice was gruff, but his bearded face had colored at Mallory's praise. Where's Brother Michael right now, eh? Good old Mickey.
Hong Kong, I think, Mallory said.
Mick would be here today with us, surely, if luck had put his ship in port in England. He was never the sort to flinch from a proper fight, our Michael.
I've seen Ernestina and Agatha since I was back, Brian said, and their dear little one.
He said nothing about Dorothy. The family did not talk about Dorothy anymore.
Brian shifted on the lumpy canvas, turning a wary eye on the looming crenellations of a palace of Saventry.
Don't care much for a fight in the streets, he remarked. That was the only place the Ruskies really stung us, in the streets of Odessa, scrapping and sniping house to house in the city like bandits. That's no civilized war.
He frowned.
Why didn't they stand up straight and give you an honest battle?
Brian glanced at him in surprise, then laughed, a bit oddly.
Well, they surely tried that at first, at Alma and Inkerman, but we gave them such a hell of a toweling that it knocked them into a panic. You might call that partly my doing, I suppose. The Royal Artillery, Ned.
Do tell, Mallory said.
We're the most scientific of the forces. They love the artillery, your military rads.
Brian snuffed another fat smokestack spark with a spit-dampened thumb.
Special military savantry. Dreamy little fellers, with specks on their noses and figures in their heads. Never seen a sword drawn or a bayonet. Don't need to see such things to win a modern war. 'Tis all trajectories and fuse timings.
Brian watched with alert suspicion as a pair of men in baggy raincoats sidled down the road.
The Ruskies did what they could. Huge redoubts at the Redan and Sevastopol. When our heavy guns opened up, they came apart like cracker boxes. Then they fell back into trench works, but the grape shot from the mortar organs worked like a marvel.
Brian's eyes were distant now, focused on memory.
You could see it, Ned. White smoke and dirt flying up at the head of the barrage line, every round falling neat and true as the trees in an orchard. And when the shelling stopped, our infantry, French allies mostly, they did a deal of the footwork, would trot in over the palisades and finish poor Ivan off with wind-up rifles.
The papers said the Russians fought with no respect for military decency.
They got mortal desperate when they found they couldn't touch us, Brian said. Took to partisan work, fighting from ambush, firing on white flags and such. Ugly business, dishonorable. We couldn't put up with that. Had to take measures.
At least it was all over swiftly, Mallory said. One doesn't like war, but it was time to teach Tsar Nicholas a lesson. I doubt the tyrant will ever tug the lion's tail again.
Brian nodded. It's right astonishing what those new incendiary shells can do. You can lay 'em down in a gridwork, neat as pie.
His voice fell. You should have seen Odessa burning, Ned. Like a flaming hurricane it was. A giant hurricane.
Yes, I read about that. Mallory nodded. There was a storm fire in the siege of Philadelphia. Very similar business. Very remarkable principle.
Ah, said Brian. That's the problem with the Yankees. No military sense. To think of doing that to your own cities. Why, you'd have to be a cat-handed fool.
They're a queer folk, the Yanks, Mallory said. Well, some folk are too chuckle-headed to manage themselves, and that's a fact, Brian said.
He glanced about warily as Tom piloted the Zephyr past the smoldering wreckage of an omnibus.
Did you take to the Yankees at all in America?
Never saw Americans, just Indians.
And the less said about that, the better, thought Mallory.
What did you think of India, by the way?
It's a dreadful place, India, Brian said readily. Brim full of queer marvels, but dreadful. There's only one folk in Asia with any sense, and that's the Japanese.
I heard you took part in an Indian campaign, Mallory said.
but I never was quite sure who those sepoys were exactly. Sepoys are native troops. We had a rash of trouble with mutineers, Moslem nonsense about pig fat in their rifle cartridges. It was sheer native foolishness, but Moslems don't care to eat pork, you know, all very superstitious. It looked dicey, but the Viceroy of India hadn't given the native regiments any modern artillery. One battery of Wolseley mortar organs can send a Bengali regiment straight to hell in 5 minutes. Brian's gold-braided shoulders glittered as he shrugged. Still, I saw barbarities at Meerut and Lucknow during the rebellion. You'd not think any man could do such vile, savage things, especially our own native soldiers that we ourselves had trained. Fanatics, Mallory nodded. Your common Indian, though, must be surely grateful for a decent civil government, railroad, telegraph, aqueducts, and such. Oh, said Brian, when you see some Hindu fakir sitting in a temple niche, filthy naked with a flower on his hair, who's to say what goes on in that queer headpiece of his? He fell silent, then pointed sharply over Mallory's shoulder. Over there. What are those rascals doing? Mallory turned and looked. In the mouth of an adjoining street, the paving had been taken over by a large and thriving ring of gamblers. They're tossing dice, Mallory explained. A knot of shabby, disheveled men, scouts of some primitive kind, lawless picket, were standing lookout under an awning, passing a bottle of gin. One fat ruffian gestured obscenely as the Zephyr chugged past, and his startled companions hooted disbelieving taunts from behind their rag masks. Brian flung himself full length across the coal wain and peered over the wooden wall. Are they armed? Mallory blinked. I don't think they mean us any harm. They're going to rush us, Brian announced. Mallory glanced at his brother in surprise, but to his greater astonishment he saw that Brian was quite right. The shabby men were capering after the Zephyr, almost skipping down the empty street, with a shake of their fists and a slosh of their gin bottle. They seemed possessed with an angry, yapping energy, like farm dogs pursuing a carriage. Brian rose to one knee, untoggled his holster flap, set his hand to the large, queer pistol butt within it. He was almost flung from the wain as Thomas hit the Zephyr's throttle. Mallory grabbed his brother's belt and hauled him back to sprawling safety. The Zephyr racketed smoothly up the street, a small cascade of coal pattering out the back with the shock of acceleration. Behind them, the pursuers stopped short in disbelief and stooped like idiots to pick at the fallen coal as if they were emeralds. How did you know they would do that? Mallory asked. Brian knocked coal dust from his trouser knees with a pocket kerchief. I knew it. But why? 'Cause we're here and they're there, I suppose. 'Cause we ride and they walk. He looked at Mallory red-faced, as if the question were more trouble to him than a gunfight. Mallory sat back, looking away. Take the mask, he said mildly, holding it out. I brought it just for you. Brian smiled then, sheepish, and knotted the little thing about his neck. End of Side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.